This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Delighted to have such a wonderful crowd here this afternoon. I acknowledge that we have this conversation on Kaurna land and hosted here by the beautiful University of Adelaide grounds. My name is Rick Saar. I teach law at the University of South Australia, and you'll see that one of our sponsors this afternoon is our university. I'll be saying something a bit more about that at the end of the session. Welcome to this session, A Politics for a New Century. A little housekeeping before we begin. Please switch off your mobile phone or to silent, although I'm told here you are most welcome to tweet. So if you'd like to tweet to someone, whomever, somewhere out there in the universe, it is at Ideas Adelaide, and our hashtag is #AFOI. So if that means anything to you and you like tweeting, please take note of that. Today's speakers, we have Michael Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus. Let me say something briefly about both of them, and then I'll ask Ted to speak first, followed by Michael, then we'll have a series of questions and be finishing just before quarter after the hour. Michael Schellenberger is president and co-founder of Breakthrough Institute and co-authored with Ted the book Breakthrough: From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility. I just checked the imprint tent. There are three copies of that left. So if you need to get a copy, you need to be quick at the imprint tent right outside the door here. They argued for positive post-environmental politics. He and Ted published an essay called The Death of Environmentalism, which argued against apocalyptic climate rhetoric in favour of an aspirational discourse. Michael was named one of Time magazine's 2008 Heroes of the Environment. The Breakthrough Institute's strategy to make clean energy cheap was the recent subject of a profile on National Public Radio's Morning Edition. He co-founded the Apollo Alliance and has written for The Times, that is the New York Times, The Washington Post, The New Republic, The American Prospect, Ceylon, Harvard Law and Policy Review, and Democracy. He will follow Ted, so in introducing or bringing Ted to the lectern, let me tell you something about him. Ted is an author, researcher, political strategist. He's a recognised authority on climate and energy policy. He co-authored The Death of Environmentalism. He was equally named Time magazine's 2008 Hero of the Environment. His writings have appeared in magazines, newspapers and journals, including The New Republic and The New York Times. He's a co-founder of the Breakthrough Institute, which is based in Oakland, California. It works at the nexus of climate, energy and environmental and economic policy. He's managing partner of American Environics, there's a new word for us, a research and consulting firm using cutting-edge research and methodologies to understand the evolution of American social values to progressive political projects. Ted Nordhaus's name means in German North House, which is entirely apt for a place on North Terrace. Would you welcome Ted Nordhaus at the lectern?
Well, thanks for the great introduction. Thanks for having me here. Really, first time in Australia, so it's been great to learn a little bit about Australia and see the sights a bit. But let's get on to the matters at hand. So first, just following up on that introduction, just a little bit more about us. We're both lifelong progressives. We say liberals in the US. I think the meaning's slightly different here. Both have spent much of our career prior to starting the Breakthrough Institute working in the American environmental movement, both as staff and consultants to virtually every major environmental group in the country over about 20 years. We left the environmental movement because we had to leave it to reform it, we are probably sort of best known as critics of conventional environmentalism, environmental philosophy and strategies to deal with the ecological challenges that the world is faced with today. We are broadly pro-modernization. I'm going to talk a little bit more about what that means and why we think that is so important to thinking about a new politics for this century we've just entered. We were, was mentioned in our introduction, named Heroes of the Environment by Time Magazine in 2008. Wired Magazine called our book Breakthrough, said that it could be the most important thing to happen to environmentalism since Silent Spring. And we've just launched a new journal called, not surprisingly or terribly creatively, the Breakthrough Journal, which is dedicated to modernizing liberalism. And we're obviously going to talk a lot more about what, for us, that means. So let's talk a little bit about modernization. Well, the place to start is that literally technology made us not only modern humans, but humans. If you kind of go back deep into the record of human evolution, what you find is that we literally evolved, we became human as we evolved, our tools evolved, and the human systems that we created with those tools evolved. And that has really been the sort of long-term dynamic of modernization, human systems of various kinds becoming more and more powerful over time, a greater ability to manage and engineer environments that are better suited to our development and prosperity. Our view is that states have increasingly played a crucial role in this process of modernization and human development. That as those systems have become more powerful, as human societies have become more complex, the role of the state in managing and driving development has only expanded. And with that, we've seen rising living standards, quality of life in all sorts of ways, first with the development of agriculture, and then obviously much more rapidly after the Industrial Revolution. Those sort of epochal shifts in human sort of societies have brought with them a process of democratization, expansion of rights to minorities and women, rising individualism, urbanization. Right now we're in the process of one of the most remarkable transformations of human societies ever, as virtually the entire human population over the next century will leave traditional rural ways of living and systems and move to cities, 10 billion of us. Obviously, all of these processes sort of, in our view, kind of are a process of meeting a rising hierarchy of needs. For those of you, probably most of you familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, first meeting our most basic needs for physical security, shelter, feeding ourselves, and then meeting higher needs for self-esteem, connection with others, self-actualization. And in our view, this process is fundamentally a salutary one. And its acceleration is salutary, even as it brings with it new challenges, and it creates new kinds of problems that we have to deal with, which are unintended consequences of our development. From 1940 to 1970, particularly, the center left was a modernizing force and really reflected a modernizing ideology. So And during this period, which was certainly in the United States as well as much of the rest of the world, a time when the center left really sort of dominated government and politics, we saw governments create, literally build the infrastructure of our present day modernity. Roads, electricity, clean water, sewage treatment. The state obviously literally rescued capitalism in the 1930s. Cold War military investments, particularly by the U.S. military, whatever you think of the Cold War and the various military adventures that followed, drove investments in a whole range of technologies that sort of fundamentally transformed modern life. Radios, microchips, the internet, GPS, jet engines, lasers. Governments also created most of the energy technologies that we rely upon today or that we hope to rely upon in the future. That includes nuclear power, hydroelectric power, gas turbines, solar energy. This period also marked, in developed societies, a market expansion of civil rights and civil liberties protections that were both extended to populations by their governments and demanded of their governments by those populations in a mutually reinforcing process. We obviously got modern entitlements, our pensions and healthcare, and a range of other sort of benefits from the state that assured sort of basic living standards for the populations of most developed societies. Environmental protections, so we see a dramatic expansion in sort of government-led measures to clean up the environment, preserve natural places. And we had the Green Revolution, radically increasing yields around the world. You see there the picture of Norman Borlaug, who won the Nobel Prize and was really the father of the Green Revolution, which sort of extended the ability to feed ourselves to a population of, I think 3 or 4 billion that is now close to 7 billion, and we continue to feed ourselves as we see continuing increases in agricultural productivity and yields. So I'm going to turn it over to Michael now, who is going to talk about sort of what happened to liberalism.
Thanks, Ted. And I want to thank the sponsors of the festival for bringing us out. It's really been a fantastic trip for us to meet Australians, especially the younger generation that is quite interested, I think, in modernizing sort of a center-left politics. I would also add, we're here with one of our Breakthrough Generation Fellows. We have 10 fellows come and work at the Institute every summer with paid fellowships, very competitive program. One of them is here with us, Lee Eubank, our first and only Aussie fellow. And afterwards, we've got a bunch of the issues of Breakthrough Journal that we're going to give away for free if anybody would like a copy. So what happens after 1970? You start to see a turn away from modernity by the left in the United States and throughout much of the wealthy modern world. And this, in part, is a reaction to a whole set of negative uses of technology, nuclear weapons, environmental problems. You see the rise of an environmental movement that in many ways is an anti-technology movement, Silent Spring. And while there was always more ambivalence, perhaps, about technology during that period, it starts to take a much harder edged view over the coming decades. And we like to point out this is a wider cultural shift. So you see the most popular sci-fi show in America, really probably throughout the world, is Star Trek. This is a global federation. These are sort of the United Nations blue helmets who go out and make sure people aren't fighting and everyone's getting along and the Klingons aren't messing with the peaceful people. And it was it was racially diverse. You had Asians, African Americans. It was sort of an optimism, a sense that the world was coming together. It was a kind of sci-fi cosmopolitanism. And then look what happens. You then move to Star Wars, 1977, I believe. And in this period, you get a baby boomer, George Lucas, who presents a very different picture. In Star Wars, the Global Federation is the dark side of the Force. The moderns are the bad guys. The guys with the technology are the ones that are out to, that are undemocratic, that are oppressive. And of course, the good guys are the pre-moderns, Obi-Wan Kenobi there on the right. You know, later you get the Ewoks, who they form an alliance with, the forest people, and you start to see it in all sorts of ways. The good guys are the little guys that hang out under the mushrooms in the forest. The bad guys are the ones with the steel ships and modernity. So you see something going on in the culture here. And you see a move towards apocalyptic discourses. Nuclear, people forget, was viewed as a sign of hope. You know, there was a lot of guilt, at least in the United States, around Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They wanted to see nuclear power put to positive use. The idea was cheap electricity, lifting people up, but suddenly became viewed with a kind of apocalyptic foreboding. And the word apocalypse is, of course, the Greek word. We tend to think of apocalypse as simply a kind of a catastrophe, but in fact, apocalypse was always both a kind of collapse of this world and the emergence of a new world, a world where small is beautiful, where we would all be sort of living in harmony with nature. And again, 1968, so if you have Norman Borlaug there with the Green Revolution, expanding agricultural yields, really averting mass starvations. From the environmental movement, you get the population bomb, which says there's just too many people on Earth. We should cut off food aid. Let fewer starvations now will prevent more starvations later. We need sterilization. Really, again, a hard-edged move against modernity. You see it in sort of the rise of kind of limits to growth. There's sort of a sense that that nature can't handle all this economic growth. It's very common in the discourse. You hear it from people who say technology can't save us. Of course, against, 200,000 years of human evolution, but the idea is really we're at the end here. This is the final days. And a discourse that was traditionally associated with really the right wing or with kind of Christian evangelicals is really embraced by liberals. And what a dramatic shift that was. You also start to see, this is, a photo of what's going on here in Australia, the anti-carbon, I'm told that even saying carbon tax indicates some sort of political bent. So the people who say they're against the carbon tax in Australia, you see a division within the left between the kind of traditional working class, labor movement, blue-collar workers, and knowledge workers. Folks like us, people who work in offices, who sit in front of their screens all day, we become increasingly alienated from the mode of production, from productive activities, and we start to think that those productive activities are going to be our downfall. We start to think, we imagine industrial civilization is not sustainable. That's the idea. This can't last. There's not enough planet Earth for all of the Chinese and Indians in the world to live like we live. Meanwhile, of course, government is becoming really invisible. Really, every technology you have in your cell phone, as Ted described, was created by the U.S. military. Microchips, GPS, even the touch screens. The internet itself was invented in a Defense Department laboratory, but nobody knows that. All you do is you just kind of go, thank God for Steve Jobs. The private sector delivers this. We have a relationship with private corporate brands, and we tend to see the state as inefficient, sinister, and certainly not capable of innovation. And meanwhile, also the publics, in at least the wealthy world, feel increasingly entitled to a whole set of benefits of the modern world, but we don't really feel like paying for them. This is more acute in the United States, I think, than it is in Europe and Australia. I think there's a question about whether that's because we're a little bit of an outlier, maybe we're a little bit ahead of where other publics are headed. But what you see is sort of people in the United States, they say, keep government out of my Medicare. Well, Medicare is a government program, so people sort of forget this. So we sort of call this sort of an entitlement culture. We want all the benefits of modernity, but yet we don't want to pay for them. And meanwhile, we are increasingly suspicious of modernity as something that is liberatory or emancipatory. And of course, meanwhile, you see in a political sphere the rise of neoliberalism. Again, on one side, you have a kind of working class labor movement. On the other, you have knowledge workers who believe that the market should be fixed or corrected. So, for example, in Australia, when people think, does government have a role or not? On one side of people, they say, no, the government has no role. Global warming isn't a problem or isn't real. We shouldn't do anything about it. And the others say, no, government has a role. But the only thing they imagine government doing is making fossil fuels cost more. There's no sense that there's anything else that you could do. What else could government do if it tried to get involved in technology innovation? I think we all know in advance that it would only screw that up. So it just disproves my point that technology can save us. I can't even get the remote to work. Okay, a more aspirational politics. Sometimes you have to look back in the past to be inspired for going forward. What does a new politics look like? Broadly, it's a shift from this entitlement culture, from entitlement societies, to innovation societies, societies that are creative, that are risk-taking, that accept a huge amount of failure in order to get very important successes. We have a sense of gratitude as like a core value towards development, modernity, and technology. Instead of taking it for granted that clean water comes in, dirty water goes out, that the lights come on every time we turn a switch, we actually appreciate that. You have a sense of wonder and awe. You hear those words used in relationship to the natural world, but of course we fail to use those often in relationship to technology. Governments, of course, and this is where this new center-left politics needs to break from neoliberalism, suggests that governments actively shape and drive modernization. Sometimes we get accused by our colleagues in the environmental movement of just being kind of pro-status quo. Well, modernization is already happening. You guys are just saying go with the flow. In fact, quite the contrary, modernization will be happening, but it's a question of how we shape that, where we direct that, where do we want to marshal all of these incredible energies and creativity of the development process toward. The other thing that we realize is that really 90% or more of economic growth comes from technology innovation. There's really no sense in talking about economic growth outside of a context of innovation. It's what makes labor more efficient, more productive. It's what makes energy more efficient and more productive. And obviously, we have a shared common interest in continuing that process. It's also an acknowledgement that those big technology platforms, the internet, microchips, electricity, these platforms can only be created by government because by the public, making a shared investment. No private company can do that stuff on its own. It requires major investments by governments, often hiring private firms to execute the work, but nonetheless, there's a sense of which if you want to create new technology platforms, you've got to have long-term big investments by the public sector. And instead of viewing environmental problems as a sign of the coming apocalypse, we would instead view them as unintended consequences of development, and that we're going to deal with them through more development and more technology. We're not going to solve global warming by all of us trying to live with less. Literally, it's an impossible task. We can show you the numbers on it. You'd have to go to Somalia levels of energy in the developed world in order to reduce emissions sufficiently. Instead, what we need to do if we want to deal with a problem like climate change is embrace technological innovation, make clean energy cheap, make nuclear power safer, smaller, cheaper, so that we can move away from fossil energy. And I think finally, the new politics has to be skeptical of identity politics, which is overly divisive, kind of a resentment-based discourses that I think kind of get in the way of actually speaking about what we have in common and what we share. And then finally, there's some sense in which we need to be reformers of the public sector. It's not good enough for us to simply be pro-government. We also have to acknowledge that in many places, government really is bloated. You really do have government agencies that have overstepped their mandate or that need some pension reform or other reforms in order to become fully modern and functioning institutions. So with that, we'll stop, and thank you very much.
I think we'll stay here for the dialogue that's about to unfold. We have 30 minutes. I'll ask an initial question, and then while that's being answered, I'm going to encourage you, if you're in this lower part of the auditorium, there's a microphone right in the middle here, if you can line up behind that microphone. If you're in the upper gallery, there's a microphone off to your left. Let me start by either Ted or Michael just responding to a word that I heard a second ago, which is kind of a bit of a catchword here in the debate, the nuclear power option. Is it an option for Australia? It's completely off the agenda at the moment and has created a great deal of controversy in the last half a dozen years. Where do you stand on that?
You can go ahead.
Sure. Well, it's an option if you decide it's an option. I think when you look at the options to radically decarbonize economies right now, technologically, nuclear power is the only one that has demonstrably been able to do that anywhere in the world. There's only two societies in the world that have decarbonized their economies at rates that even begin to approach those that would be necessary to deal with climate change. That's France and Sweden. And both of them did it, France almost entirely with nuclear power, Sweden with nuclear power, and a lot of hydro. So if you are deeply concerned about climate change and the potential for particularly for catastrophic risks from climate change, you are skeptical of nuclear power, you just need to take a hard look again at just the basic math of global emissions and the realities of the technologies we have. Just full stop. You know.
Do you want to add anything?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I can later, but...
I think someone moved to the microphone. Let's have this first question here.
Yeah, hi, guys. My main question is, I feel like yesterday we had a presentation that was about drifting into failure and how a small change of language can make a massive impact on an outcome. And I guess my question is about the difference between the battle between renewable and non-renewable energy and what you see as the dichotomy between clean energy and fossil fuels. And I noticed that the trick of language is that when you talk about the debate between clean, renewable and non-renewable, that uranium is taken out of the equation because it's a non-renewable energy. And I'm wondering, is that deliberate? Because I seem, in terms of, if we assess your presentation, it seemed like 80% of it was attacking the left and the last 20% was uranium is the future. And I'd like to thank the South Australian government and the primary industry and resources for putting on today's presentation. But I'm just wondering, is this basically, I'm not aware of your work, is this basically what you do? 80% attack the environment movement, 20% advocate uranium.
And advocate uranium. I hope you would see something more there than just an attack. It's really a story about where we think the left went wrong in becoming anti-modern.
I guess I'll follow up by asking, I was really excited to see so many people here to, address the topic, a new politics for a new century. And I'm really inspired to see this many people who are genuinely interested in engaging in this topic. And I invite you in the last 25 minutes of the session to be inspiring.
I'm sorry, I missed the last
one. It's going to be inspiring, I think
you said. Yeah, I'm inviting you to be inspiring because I feel like the energy in the room is lower than it could be. And you guys have been thinking about this for a long time. So inspire us about not just the role of government but our role.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's a lot to be inspired about. I mean, you saw over the last 20 years, 500 million Chinese get lifted out of backbreaking agrarian poverty into fairly, modern lives, long lifespans. So I think there's a whole set of things that I think we in the West kind of look at with horror. China, it's making all the same mistakes we made, such as longer lifespans, greater energy consumption, better medical access. I think we look at the next century and we're very excited about the potential, and excited about the potential of development and technology to really have a world where all 10 billion people can pursue the kind of lives they want to pursue. Free, modern lives, free to love who they want to love, free to live where they want to live, free to pursue their own self-actualization to its highest degree. I think that's very exciting. Obviously, there's a whole set of challenges you're going to have, getting enough clean water for all those people, climate change, rainforest destruction, loss of biodiversity, and those problems are going to have to be dealt with through development and technology as well. So if you see a sharp critique of us of the environmental movement, it's really of that doomsaying view, this moment where we think we should be celebrating and excited and welcoming the majority of the species into modernity. Instead, we see so much fear and apprehension and apocalyptic rhetoric. So I don't know if that's inspiring or not. Often the stuff that I think is inspiring, other people go, oh, God, that sounds terrible. So
yeah, I would just add one, you know, I think, and we sort of noted it, you know, in our talk, which is why we think, you know, that an inspired sort of new politics starts with a posture of gratitude, particularly for those of us in the developed world, for the remarkable lives that we live. I mean, everybody in this room is among an incredibly, if you look at the all of the human lives that have unfolded on this planet over 200,000 years, you are far and away the freest, wealthiest, most self-actualized human beings who have ever lived on the planet. It's a remarkable thing. And a remarkable thing, much of which has been achieved just over the last couple of centuries. In the United States, and well, I don't even know if really anyone was here at the time, but, you know, over, you know, 200 years ago in the United States, 90% of the population worked in agriculture. Literally spent most of their day just trying to grow enough food to feed themselves. Today, like 2 or 3% of Americans work in agriculture. And of course, that's what allows us to be writers and architects and, you know, you name it. All of the kind of remarkable things that all of us do are made possible by that transformation. And so I think our view is that you start by embracing that, A, and B, actually, you know, some vision of actually extending that to all of humanity. What a remarkable achievement that would be. And in doing that, we have great challenges we have to overcome. But the process of overcoming those challenges is going to look a lot like the process of the last 200,000 years of overcoming a whole set of limits and challenges in order that we might lead better lives. So that's our sort of posture towards the world.
Let me take the question at the microphone at the moment. Let me also say that there's a little bit of reverb up here, and the Aussie accent's a little unusual for these ears. So if I could ask you to speak and question slowly. I recognise there's two gentlemen here on the end of the front row who have questions, and the woman over here. What I might do is take the gentleman with the dark coat, then the woman over here, then the gentleman with the white shirt, then the gentleman down here. And that might actually be it in terms of our 20 minutes. We'll see how we go with those five questioners. Yes?
I'd like to get back to some of the basics that you talked about, not the politics. I'd like to ask you, since you are so enthusiastic about new technologies, why would you be going to nuclear with all the difficulties plus the time frame? An article I read several years ago said it would take us 20 years to get to a performing nuclear power station when we have here in Australia wind, solar, hot rocks. Why isn't the new technology looking at that, not at nuclear? And the other part of the question is, where will the resources come from? Your enthusiasm about technology, but do you think they're going to be manufactured out of the air? Where is it coming from? Where they are at a cost. The resources that will be needed will be at a cost. So, you know, I just don't think we can fantasize about this stuff. We've got to think of what is the reality. Now, I'd like you to respond to that.
Do I respond, or you can do? You want to take a couple of questions, and then we can deal with them.
Let's respond to them one at a time. Okay. Can you respond to that one now?
Yeah. Ted and I were raised in the anti-nuclear movement, went to anti-nuclear rallies throughout our childhoods, were anti-nuclear until a few years ago, and then something happened, which is that we were forced to actually understand the low carbon technological options we have. And the harder we looked at it, the more that we discovered that the alternatives to fossil fuels are very expensive. So again, you know, let the debate over this begin in Australia. Solar PV is 5 times more expensive than natural gas. It's more expensive than that than coal, and that doesn't count the cost of backing it up when the sun isn't shining. Again, don't believe me. Just go look it up yourself. Spend the time doing the research on it. You know, read up on the internet. Read different sources on it. Wind is 50% more expensive than natural gas. So Australia and the United States and the developed world might implement a few of these. We might buy some of that. But we're going to triple energy consumption over the next century. And right now, there's only one low-carbon technology that is capable of doing that. We worry about the risks of nuclear. Go look at the published research, the independent research on the safety, health, accidents of all energy sources. And what you'll find is nuclear is the safest. We kind of go solar, it's so clean. There's protests in China over pollution from solar plants. And that's to produce solar panels that today offer 0.1% of our electricity, in contrast to 15% for nuclear. So when you go from 0.1% to 15% in any technology, you're going to have all sorts of unintended consequences. So I don't think we're going to get, this obviously you're an anti-nuclear crowd. I don't think there's anything that we're going to say on stage that's going to change your mind. I do hope that you keep an open mind. I do hope that you do your own research, that you allow a conversation and a dialogue to begin, because I think it's critical to the country, to the planet's future.
Let me take the gentleman with the dark coat. Yes.
Good day there. Following on some of these issues here, for people who profess this interest in innovation, you seem to be remarkably having very little faith in the quality of the research now currently taking place in alternative energies. I mean, particularly I'm thinking of research in batteries and ultracapacitors, which will make a real change in the way we use energy. The second point I want to raise, slightly different, is that it's interesting to see that you're talking about the role of the state and praising the role of the state in doing all of this. The first thought that came to mind was that finally the Americans are catching up with the rest of Europe.
I'll take that as a comment. Perhaps
so you're saying there's a role for the state and Americans are catching up to Europe. Americans are finally catching up.
Right. Perhaps a comment on European trends in this field as opposed to American trends. Is there a dualism between that, or is there a competition, or is one better than the other?
I think there's much to recommend elements of both systems. Europeans have been very good on particular kinds of infrastructure, very good on the welfare state. Not so good on investing in technological innovation, where if you kind of go and look at, someone did a study recently of the 100, I think it's Popular Science magazine, sort of went and listed the 100 most important technological innovations of the 20th century. 87 of them had been developed in the United States, I believe 90, roughly 90% of those you could trace directly back one way or another to very substantial investments by the U.S. federal government. So I think the narrative that Americans just hate all government and that America has never actually had much use for government is not actually true. But that role has obviously been quite different than the role of the state in the U.S. has looked different than it has in other places. At the same time, you need entitlements. You need to provide a whole set of basic public goods that markets don't provide. But if you don't have an economy that is innovating driving technological innovation, over the long term, it's very difficult to actually support a generous social welfare state, as we're seeing right now, for instance, in places like Greece, where there's sort of no, hardly any legal economy at all. No one is willing to pay, everybody cheats on their taxes, and at the same time, they have the most generous welfare state in Europe. So you know, I think there's a long-term crisis here that all developed economies are going to experience, which is going to be a kind of increasing public rejection of the sort of political class, which has overwhelmingly been a sort of liberal political class, and I think liberals are going to have to rethink a whole lot of stuff if they want to continue to offer their publics government that they want.
I'll take the question from the woman here. Yes, thank you.
Hi there. I wanted to ask a question related to what you said about the unintended consequences of development and the fact that these can really only be addressed by further technology and further development, which I understand in many ways. But when you put that against the paradox of environmentalists talking about the problems of any development and sort of talking up the possible catastrophe, there is a danger that any new initiative where environmentalists are saying, you know, if you do this, then the cuttlefish colony will go or whatever, and that just been seen by the developers, oh, well, they would say that, wouldn't they, because that's the way they always say it, and we don't need to take any notice because we could go ahead and our technology will solve that after the event. I suppose I'm just concerned that the genuine and well-researched problems that are identified beforehand, which are not intended consequences but are certainly not unexpected, should be given full credit by the developers. And in Australia, anyway, I don't think we have a great deal of trust between the environmental movement and the development people, because I think both sides have, if not lied, have stretched the point and not come together to have a robust dialogue. And I'd just be interested in any suggestions you have for that.
Great. I think, so if I understand your first point was sort of when we say technology and development will solve problems of technology and development, how do we make sure that that's not used as an excuse to do nothing? Isn't that your question? Yeah. So, I mean, I think what we see right now, the dominant approach to dealing with global warming is precisely that. It says, we'll put a price on carbon, and there will be all this market magic, all this technological innovation, and the technologies will sort of just come. And, of course, every transition from an older energy source to a newer energy source, from an older technology to a newer technology, every single one of them happens through inventing the new technologies, publics directly investing in those new technologies. It does not come from making the older technologies more expensive. Or as we say, you know, we didn't get personal computers by taxing typewriters. You know, we didn't get the internet by putting a cap-and-trade system on telegrams or fax machines. We got those by making those direct investments. And the lady asked, well, someone's got to pay for that. Someone's got to invest in that. Damn right. You know, it's us. We're the ones that should do that. So our view is, that's right, do not wait until you have severe ecological problems to make investments in technology. Do it now. And don't think that this is somehow like we're just guaranteed to have success. We certainly don't. I mean, we've been investing in the war on cancer, $32 billion a year in the United States for our National Institutes of Health. We don't have a cure for cancer. I mean, we have improving treatments. But I don't think anybody in the United States, and I doubt anybody in Australia, would say, well, we should really stop making those investments in biomedical technology because we don't have a cure for cancer or we don't have a vaccine yet for AIDS. You as a public, you say, this is a public good. We need to keep making these investments and we need to push hard. I think one of the lessons that we've learned is when you really take a close look at things like the creation of microchips or jet turbines, you know, which become more and more efficient over time, is you had what's called a demanding customer. In this case, the Department of Defense in the United States, that would be purchasing advanced technologies, not subsidizing old technologies, purchasing new technologies, and then demanding even better technologies the next time around. That's the posture we ought to have.
Okay, let me tell you where we are in relation to questioning, and I'm conscious of the time as well. I have the gentleman in the white shirt who's our next questioner, a young man over here. Sir, do you have a question as well? And I see one up here, and I think we'll have to call that quits for the afternoon. If we can get through those, 1, 2, 3, 4, we'll be doing very well. Let's have quick questions and see how we go.
You might have to correct me if I'm wrong, but what it sounds to me like you're saying is expressing a deep optimism in the ability for everybody on this planet to live as Australians and Americans do now. I personally can't see that as being feasible. I guess my question is, are you speaking about, when we talk about technological development and further development of our economy, are we just talking about an ongoing, eternal consumer culture? Because I can't, for the life of me, see how eternal growth on a finite planet is at all possible. So I just want you to clarify for me if you're talking more about... Sorry, are we talking about a Prius-led revolution? We all start driving a Prius, everything's sweet.
Let me pause you there in terms of the other questions. That's an excellent question. Do you want to deal with the finite limits to growth? Can we continue to consume in a finite planet?
Well, I think we may choose to consume more or less for a whole variety of reasons. But I think our view is that the big drivers of increasing resource use are not actually the kinds of conspicuous consumption that those of us in the West often like to complain about, even as we probably do more of it ourselves than we like to admit. You know, what is driving rising global resource use is a planet of 7 billion going on 10 billion, where most of those people are still building the just basic infrastructure of modern societies. You know, roads and rail systems and hospitals and you know, modern living arrangements, cities, you know, all of the stuff that, frankly, we here in the West take for granted. That's what's driving rising energy consumption primarily. That's what's driving rising demands on agriculture and forests. Those problems will be solved technologically if they're solved. They are not going to be solved by some sort of profound shift in values where half the planet is going to decide that they'd much rather live in agrarian poverty. Not going to happen. The reality is that even as we're using more resources, we're also using them much more efficiently in all sorts of ways. And I think the challenge for us is to accelerate those trends in terms of resource efficiency, as opposed to sort of imagining that there's kind of a consumer culture that's sort of driving this crisis and the ecological challenges we're faced with, and we can sort of moralize our way out of it. You know, I think you can get into kind of all sorts of what are almost theological debates about whether consumption sort of vaguely defined can go on forever on a finite planet. I think the reality of the last 200,000 years is that natural ecosystems are not what has constrained human development. It is actually what supports us today are not natural systems, they are human constructed systems, agriculture, energy use, a whole set of things, and that's likely to continue. The question is not, can we continue to survive on the planet? But how do we want to live? Do we want to save some rainforest? Do we want to save some biodiversity? Do we want to save some wild fisheries? Those are the choices that, the real choices that we'll make.
To save 30 seconds, I'll take the question up there because the gentleman's at the microphone. If I can ask you, sir, to move to the microphone. So let me take this question here and you can move. Yes, thank you. Up here.
Yeah, thank you. Going to the model that you used of the state being the driver for technological change and recognising the new forms of technological change that we will require to deal with the current problems, we therefore need to get the state to make that demand. I do not see that happening, so I'd like you to address the question of how do you get the state to make that demand, given the behaviour of the American government or the American polity at present?
Well, actually, what you've seen in the United States is a rejection of carbon pricing. That's not the same thing as a rejection of the state's role in advancing technology. So, you know, you saw it a very polarized period in the 90s when In the late 90s, Clinton was at war with the Republicans. The impeachment crisis had happened. The Congress went and increased the public investment in health research, biomedical technologies, from $10 to $32 billion. Right now, you're seeing, you just had two Republican senators in the United States both saying that instead of carbon pricing, what we need to be doing is directly investing in these technologies. So I will grant you, I will grant Churchill's remark that, you know, you can always count on Americans to do the right thing after they've exhausted all of their options. You know, I'd like to think the same thing could be said about the human race. You know, we're going to exhaust every option to deal with global warming until we finally get clear that actually what matters is making clean energy cheap, so that we can live in a world where we mostly live in cities, we have high-intensive agriculture, we've got clean energy, we've got clean water. That's a vision, you know, we've got your recycling, your materials. That's a vision of a world where we can all live modern lives, and it does not require any science fiction to get to that kind of a world. And I don't think that you're seeing states. I think you're seeing this move away from modernity and technology among knowledge workers, cultural creatives in the developed world. But I think when push comes to shove, folks are going to make the right decision, which is to do shared public investment in technology.
We have four more minutes,
and I'll take this question.
And we're happy to continue the argument outside afterwards. We love the conversation.
There's a coffee machine and a bookstore. It's a wonderful conversation out there. I'll take your comments, sir, and then yours will be the last one. Yes, so 4 minutes to go.
Very, very briefly. I'm a chemical engineer with quite a few years. I spent a lifetime in the energy industry. I'm a member of the Australian Institute of Energy. And my main interest over the years has been on the global warming issue. I was involved in the first global warming conference in Australia 25 years ago. Wow. Now, you said governments shape and drive modernisation. If we relied on the government, our government, to do something constructive about solving the energy and the pollution problem, global warming problem for the future, we would get nowhere. I have a lot of contact with government people over time, and I tell you, they're just not interested beyond what they're doing now. And my question to you is, are you, and incidentally the media is just as bad, you can't get them interested either, are you aware of the nuclear fusion developments in the south of France and its enormous potential for solving the pollution problems in the world in the future? There's enough energy in the oceans of the world to give you nuclear fusion energy for 80 million years, according to the authorities. Thank you. Are you aware of the importance of nuclear fusion?
Well, I think that you know, it's funny because you talk about nuclear fusion as if governments had nothing to do with it. I mean, you know, to the degree to which we get nuclear fusion, it's entirely, there's no private firm in the world that could develop that without enormous support from governments. So it's an interesting contrast, though, because on the one hand, you have governments that appear really unable to do anything substantially on climate change. And on the other hand, you see continuing investments in technology and hopefully expanding technology, and whether it's fusion or something else. What's very interesting in the as a sort of mental sort of experiment around technology is to kind of go, well, if in fact next year we had fusion energy, how much easier would this problem be to solve? It would make the politics of this radically different. And that's actually, when we advocate technology, part of what we're saying is technological innovation creates possibilities that don't currently exist for the political system and for political systems and societies to deal with problems that they are having a very, very hard time dealing with today. It is the most likely path to actually dealing with these kind of global scale energy and resource and environmental challenges.
So we have about a minute and a half left for your very quick question and a quick response, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you for the talk. I'll be very brief. My question has existed since about mid-1960s. In 1964, I think it was, Mr. Menzies commissioned a report. It was the Vernon Committee report, and he nominated the people who were to compile the report that read like a who's who of academic and business life in Australia. And in due course, the report was tabled in the following year. And Mr. Menzies praised the people that compiled the report, complimented them for their dedication and knowledge and enthusiasm, all to the accompaniment from Jim Cairns, come on, come on, tell us, when are you going to have the report shelved? And sure enough, he did have it shelved. And the reason for it was, he said, that politics, which is not technical, and policy, which is not technical, would not be dictated to him by economic technicians. And it seems to me that something very similar has arose in relation to the current debate on climate change, where the leader of the opposition in particular is quite vocal in his dismissal of scientific opinion in relation to this matter. So in that circumstance, how do you propose policy is going to be arrived at? Are we going to rely on politicians who really don't know what they're talking about?
Okay, the pragmatics and politics entering this particular debate in a general sense, very quickly.
Yeah, and before we close, I just want to thank everybody for engaging in the dialogue. I know we're not always going to agree on everything, but I do really appreciate that. And again, we'll be out about back to continue the conversation and to share some of the issues of the journal with you all. I think one of the most important things to understand about politics is that politics, to paraphrase Walter Lippmann, politics is not about getting everybody to agree. It's actually getting everybody to agree on a common set of actions, often for different reasons. There are a lot of good reasons to move to clean energy. 1 million people die a year of respiratory and other problems related to coal burning in the world. You've had some of the most skeptical senators in the United States show great concern over dirty energy consumption in the subcontinent. We've had a long transition towards better and better technologies, and I think that what that record shows is that you can actually get a lot of agreement, a lot of public agreement about particular technologies when they are not connected to a particular ideological perspective or particular agenda. I think that Australia is going to have a lot of success in moving towards a clean energy future, whether nuclear is part of that or not, if it actually becomes disentangled from this question of global warming. And I wish you all the best with it. So,
ladies and gentlemen, at a time when we often lurch in Australian politics across a starkly dualistic landscape, carbon trading versus great big tax, public versus private, nuclear versus non-nuclear, it's good to have a different path to consider in bringing about hopefully a more informed debate on energy in our future. Before I ask you to join me in thanking our speakers this afternoon, two quick things. One, please consider our sponsors, the Bob Hawke Ministerial Centre at UniSA and PIRSA. And secondly, I've been asked to promote the walking down of North Terrace towards Kintore Avenue, where there's that lovely circulating library in the Institute building on the corner there. 2:15 this afternoon, Natasha Mitchell and Ian Gibbons. 3:00 this afternoon, Sarah Bishop and Jody Melbourne. People are sort of getting lost, drifting down that way. So if I can encourage you to seek out those forums as well, would you join me in thanking both Ted and Michael today?
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.